Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 77, but who's counting? It's Saturday, August 29th. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. Welcome to the People's School of Public Health and the University of Life. You are listening to locally produced non-commercial content from WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. Let's get right to it with a local and state update on the status of our COVID-19 epidemic. This from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Just 6 of 88 counties are red on latest Ohio coronavirus advisory map. Just 6 counties are red or level 3 in the state's coronavirus advisory map, the lowest number in the 9 weeks Ohio's been utilizing the color-coded system. Governor Mike DeWine unveiled the latest map on Thursday showing the following 6 counties in red: Lorain, Erie, Lucas, Mercer, Preble, and Montgomery. Cuyahoga County for the second week remained off the list of red counties. This was the first week Franklin County was downgraded from red. Okay, well, here in Lucas County, newly identified infections appear to still be decreasing slowly, now at a level below our initial wave's peak, although about 5 times the low in June. Still, Lucas County, relative to Ohio's other 6 metropolitan areas, is the worst off. Lucas County has had a slow, steady drop in the percent positivity among those tested in Ohio. Unfortunately, that has reversed in the last week. The total number of tests performed in Ohio has leveled off and even slightly increased after dropping for several weeks. The current 5% positivity rate is still lower than the 6% from a month ago. Active cases in Lucas County nursing homes seem to be holding steady, though the level of infection is much higher than outside of nursing homes. In some good news, cell phone data in Ohio in the last week has shown a drop in encounter density. That is the number of people gathering in one place at one time. Okay, let's look at some interesting new reports on confirmed reinfections with COVID-19. This from Time. A new study suggests COVID-19 reinfection is possible. Here's what we know. Preliminary research release suggests it's possible that COVID-19 twice, but experts say the news is not as concerning as the headline may seem. The new research, which was accepted for publication in the journal Clinical Infectious Diseases, details the case of a 33-year-old man living in Hong Kong. He first tested positive for COVID-19 in late March and developed symptoms including cough, sore throat, fever, and headache. He made a full recovery, but again tested positive for COVID-19 while traveling home from Europe in mid-August. This time, he did not have any symptoms. The Hong Kong-based researchers behind the study say the man's case is the first proven example of reinfection with SARS-CoV-2, the virus that caused COVID-19. There have been other documented cases of patients who tested positive for COVID-19 multiple times, but it has not been clear whether they're truly reinfected or some of the virus's genetic material lingers within the body. But in some way, the case is actually encouraging, says Akiko Iwasaka, a professor of immunology at the Yale School of Medicine who is not involved in the study. There's no need to panic over this reinfection news, Iwasaki says. Even though he got reinfected, this is a good example of how immunity should work in a person. By that, he means that the man's first infection likely protected him enough that he did not develop symptoms during the second infection. There's no guarantee all patients' immune systems will react this way, Iwasaki says, but it's still a promising sign. It's also not clear whether the man was contagious during his second brush with coronavirus. The amount of virus in his system suggested he could pass it on to others, but there's no evidence as to whether he did or not. That's an important question, Iwasaka says. If reinfected patients are contagious even if they are asymptomatic, herd immunity, the point at which enough of a population is immune to a disease to slow its spread, would be difficult to achieve without a vaccine. If reinfection does turn out to be common, it could be an argument for vaccinating even those who have recovered from COVID-19, but right now it's difficult to apply the paper's findings at scale, beyond urging everyone, whether they've had COVID-19 or not, to wear a mask and continue practicing social distancing. And in this continuing story from Reuters, coronavirus reinfections raise concerns about immunity. Two European patients are confirmed to have been reinfected with COVID-19, raising concerns about people's immunity to the coronavirus as the world struggles to tame the pandemic. The cases in Belgium and the Netherlands follow a report this week by researchers in Hong Kong about a man who had contracted a different strain of the virus 4.5 months after being declared recovered, the first such second infection to be documented. Still, Dr. David Strain, a clinical senior lecturer at the University of Exeter and chair of the British Medical Association's Medical Academic Staff Committee, said the cases were worrying for at least two reasons. The first is that it suggests that previous infection is not protective. The second is that it raises the possibility that vaccinations may not provide the hope that we've been waiting for. Okay, and in a third story in this vein from Stat News, scientists are reporting several cases of COVID-19 reinfection, but the implications are complicated. Following the news this week of what appears to have been the first confirmed case of COVID-19 reinfection, other researchers have been coming forward with their own reports, one in Belgium, another in Netherlands, and now one in Nevada. Woohoo, the first U.S. case. What caught experts' attention about the case of the 25-year-old Reno man was not that he appears to have contracted SARS-CoV-2, the name of the virus that causes COVID-19, a second time. Rather, it's that his second bout was more serious than the first. Of course, this is different than the original Hong Kong case that we reported on. So obviously, this is a good example of how a story unfolds as we get more and more information with confirmed reinfections. It's very significant that these are really confirmed infections. There was a lot of doubt about earlier reports. And of course, this has been at three different regions of the world. So it seems that it's not isolated to one area. But also, it leaves open the question about whether reinfection will harm the ability to either get herd immunity or potential development of an effective vaccine. Okay, but in somewhat better news from Science Daily, neutralizing antibodies appear to protect humans from coronavirus infection. A Seattle fishing vessel that departed port in May returned 18 days later with an unusual haul, the first human evidence that neutralizing antibodies provide protection from reinfection by SARS-CoV-2. The research is published in the Journal of Clinical Microbiology. Although SARS-CoV-2 swept the vessel, infecting 104 of 122 people on board, all three individuals who tested positive for neutralizing antibodies prior to embarking remained healthy during and following the expedition. These antibodies likely protect people from being reinfected, said corresponding author Alex Greninger, assistant director of clinical virology at the University of Washington Medical Center. The titers found in these three individuals look like they're attainable with the vaccines under study, he said, referring to data emerging from the clinical trials. A titer is the measurement of antibodies in blood. I'm optimistic about the vaccine. Despite having only three people in the protected group, Dr. Greninger said that the high percentage of those on board who became infected, more than 85%, render the findings highly statistically significant. One disappointment from the data, the high percentage of crew members infected suggests that any pre-existing cross-reactive immunity caused by prior infection from other seasonal coronaviruses, such as cold viruses, provides limited protection against SARS-CoV-2 infection, the report states. And so the story goes on. Okay, well, I'd like to switch gears and talk about returning to colleges and universities. This from The Hill. As COVID-19 surges on campus, in-person learning becomes less of a reality. Colleges and universities are already shifting from in-person instruction to online classes after hundreds of students on campuses across the country tested positive for COVID-19, throwing cold water on hopes for the fall semester. In the past week, big-name schools such as Notre Dame, Michigan State, and University of North Carolina have moved classes online after briefly resuming in-person instruction, and other universities are likely to do the same in the coming weeks as the explosion of cases continues. Clusters have also been identified in other universities that remain open, threatening to spill over into college towns and cities across America. But as cases continue to rise in these communities, experts warn that in-person instruction at universities will most likely prove infeasible in the middle of a pandemic. College-age students and young adults are the main demographic currently spreading the disease, according to recent data. This fact puts the student population, faculty, staff, and communities they reside in at risk. The World Health Organization warned this week that young adults are becoming major spreaders of the virus, particularly those who don't know they have it because their symptoms are mild or non-existent. We know from several studies that young adults spread the virus at very high rates. Bringing college and university students to campus, living in close proximity, will be a perfect setup for the virus to spread quickly, said Catherine Auger, Associate Chair for Outcomes at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. Students of this particular age group engage in risky behaviors such as partying that help spread COVID-19. And some students are arriving from other cities and states, some which might be hotspots for COVID-19, creating the possibility they could seed outbreaks in their college towns. It is very difficult in this moment of time in the United States to bring huge numbers of people together and assume that cases won't spread, especially in this age group, said Dr. Michael Mina, an assistant professor of epidemiology at the Harvard School of Public Health. I think it is one of the most difficult age groups. It's not high school where you can realistically try to keep most people from partying, and it's not elementary school, and it's not adults. It's one age group where famously it has a lot of people who come together on a regular basis and congregate, and most likely without masks, and that's just the reality of college life for most people. 37% of higher learning institutions plan to hold some or all classes in person this fall, a drop from 74% that planned to as of June, according to the College Crisis Initiative, a project at Davidson College that seeks to learn how colleges and universities innovate in a crisis mindset. I just don't see a whole lot of schools making it all the way through the semester, said Matt McFadden, Vice President of Strategy and Accounts at Simpson Scarborough, a higher education marketing and research agency. What we're seeing right now is it's almost impossible to prepare, even though they spent all summer doing it. It's just something that nobody's ever dealt with. Mina said colleges and universities should ensure that they have an adequate testing and contact tracing infrastructure, as well as the capacity to quarantine and isolate students with COVID-19. It's not enough to test all students once, but institutions should have access to fast surveillance testing that can test students multiple times a semester to detect cases before they become outbreaks. Okay, I'd like to stop here and do a little bit of an insert of a story and local reporting. Our own University of Toledo is back to in-person classes, although it's somewhat modified with reduced number of classes. But in the first week of reporting, they've already had 60-plus cases of positives, and that's both among students and staff. And the very limited testing, only a matter of hundreds of tests per week that they're doing, and no testing of all students and staff before they start. So we'll have to see how that rolls out. Okay, back to the other story. But even as schools endure these difficulties, in-person instruction is resuming at hundreds of institutions this fall. This, in part, is due to schools' financial stability. Elite schools like Harvard and Princeton have resources to expand testing and conduct classes online, but less wealthy schools and smaller state and private schools do not. These schools are more likely to reopen because of a dependence on tuition and room and board revenue. There's definitely a financial obligation for them to open. They support thousands of employees, even at smaller schools, and so not opening at full capacity is detrimental to their own microeconomy. Institutions might also feel obligated to keep campuses open to support students who don't have stable learning environments or resources at home. Experts warn outbreaks at universities can lead to rises in cases within their communities. While young adults are far less likely to experience serious COVID-19 illness, they can still spread it to people who will, namely older adults and people with underlying conditions. Opening colleges and universities can also make it more difficult to open K-12 classrooms, which should be the priority, some experts say, because the impacts of missing in-person instruction are greater on children, especially younger ones. College students can also better adjust to online learning. As colleges reopen, it is quite probable that community members will community numbers will rise to the point that we're unable to have in-person classes for younger children, Auger added. She noted that the Ohio State University has students living on campus, but the city of Columbus has decided to have virtual learning for K-12. Therefore, opening colleges will have trade-offs with younger student learning, she added. This is just, of course, another side effect of not having a well-coordinated strategy, certainly not nationally, but even within a state, about how we're going to handle the education of young people all the way from the beginning through the university level. Okay, well, next up from the New York Times, Florida judge strikes down order requiring schools to physically reopen amid COVID-19 risk. A Florida judge ruled that the state's requirement that public schools open their classrooms for in-person instruction violates the Florida Constitution because it, quote, arbitrarily disregards safety and denies local school boards the ability to decide when students can safely return. The ruling was a victory for the American Federation of Teachers, the nation's second largest teachers union, and one of its affiliates, the Florida Education Association. The union sued Governor Ron DeSantis and Richard Corcoran, the education commissioner, last month in the first lawsuit of its kind in the country. The state's order required that school districts give students the option to go back to school in person by August 31st or risk losing crucial state funding. An exception was made only for Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties, which have been the hardest hit by the coronavirus, and plan to start the school year online. During a three-day hearing last week, the unions presented testimony from public health experts and teachers concerned about risking their health. One teacher said he would quit to avoid exposure to the virus. Another, who is quadriplegic, said he could not afford to leave his job, though his doctor had warned him that COVID-19 would threaten his life. In a pandemic, none of these things are great victories, but it is a reprieve for human life, said Randy Weingarten, the president of the American Federation of Teachers. It is a pushback on reckless disregard of human life. It is a pushback on politics overtaking safety and the science and the well-being of communities. Okay, and another sampling of university reopenings, this from ABC News. More than 1,200 students test positive for COVID-19 at a major university. As of today, more than 1,200 students and 166 employees and staff have tested positive for COVID-19 at the University of Alabama. Okay, I'm not going to do this whole story, but I wanted to show those numbers just as an example. I looked up the number of students and the number of employees, and the proportion of employees and students that are affected is not that different, meaning that these outbreaks are not primarily concentrated in students. They very much affect employees. And this is a message that we need to understand, to think that an epidemic, an infectious disease epidemic, is going to be contained amongst large populations of thousands or tens of thousands of people when they're interacting in almost any way with other populations is kind of crazy.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, we're going to switch gears here and move to the ongoing pathetic federal response to the coronavirus epidemic. This from The Hill. CDC testing guidance change was approved by White House task force. According to multiple reports, top political officials forced the CDC to make the change. The New York Times reported the CDC did not write the guidance, but it was forced on the agency. President Trump has long said he thinks the U.S. conducts too many tests, and the high numbers of positive COVID-19 tests those tests discover make him look bad. Under the new testing guidance, which was quietly updated, asymptomatic people do not need to be tested for coronavirus, even if they have been in close contact with an infected person. The agency made the move by updating its website, but did not make any public announcement or explain the reasoning behind the major revision. The previous guidelines had urged tests for anyone who had been exposed, whether they had developed symptoms or not. And also from the Hill, CDC says asymptomatic people don't need testing, draws criticism from experts. The move drew widespread criticism and confusion from public health experts, who said that testing to identify asymptomatic people with the virus is important, and that the change could undermine contact tracing, a core strategy for slowing the spread of the virus. The most recent guidelines seem to give up any pretense of using contact tracing to control COVID. The whole point of contact tracing is to find asymptomatic contacts of known cases and isolate them. If you aren't even going to test them, certainly no point in tracing. Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at Columbia University, was more succinct in her tweet. Now, what the hell kind of CDC recommendation is this? We need to be doing more testing, not less, she wrote. And from Reuters, pushback from the states. California, Florida, New York, Texas will not follow new U.S. COVID-19 testing plan. Several large U.S. states are not heeding new federal health officials' calls to reduce COVID-19 testing of some exposed to the virus, joining a broad rebuke of the Trump administration by public health leaders. Arizona, California, Connecticut, Florida, Illinois, Texas, New Jersey, and New York all plan to continue to test asymptomatic people who have been exposed to COVID-19, despite new guidance from the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention suggesting that such tests may not be needed. Okay, and these efforts seem to be part of a much broader attack. This from The Hill. Trump turns up pressure on FDA. President Trump is ratcheting up pressure on the Food and Drug Administration to approve treatments and a vaccine for the coronavirus. The agency announced an emergency use authorization for convalescent plasma to treat COVID-19 patients following extraordinary sustained attacks on the agency by Trump. The president accused the deep state at the FDA of slowing the development of treatments and vaccines before the November election. Trump appeared to reiterate that belief during a news conference, telling reporters that he thought some health officials were allowing decisions to be held up for political reasons. The campaign being waged against public health officials has alarmed outside experts who fear politicizing the FDA could undermine confidence in the agency or, worse, result in an unproven vaccine being pushed out to the public just before Election Day. The FDA was once again bullied into doing something that initially it wasn't going to do, said Paul Offit, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Offit said Trump's tweet attacking the FDA was, quote, exactly what you most fear. You get the sense he's trying to get a vaccine or vaccines approved before November 3rd, which I think scares people. It should scare people. It makes you think that these vaccines may not be adequately tested. The plasma announcement marked a turnaround for the agency, coming just days after officials at the National Institute of Health staged a rare intervention to stop the FDA from issuing the emergency use authorization. The way the public part was handled will erode precious public confidence. You earn public confidence in small drops, and you lose it in buckets. You saw convalescent plasma, you saw remdesivir, you'll soon see vaccines pouring out years ahead of what they would have been under a more traditional administration, where they would have taken years to come up with this stuff, Trump said. The plasma authorization is the latest instance of public health officials seemingly making a decision related to COVID-19 after public pressure from the White House. Many outside observers felt the FDA bowed to political pressure earlier this year when it issued an emergency use authorization for hydroxychloroquine, an anti-malaria drug that Trump, his allies, and members of the administration continued to promote as a cure for COVID-19 despite insufficient medical evidence to support the claim. In another instance, the White House reportedly pressured the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to change its guidance on reopening schools in order to emphasize the importance of children returning to classrooms while downplaying potential risks. And this additional coverage from Stat News, Trump has launched an all-out attack on the FDA. Will its scientific integrity survive? The most striking change at the agency is the appointment of an ultra-political conservative. an emerging pattern that some FDA insiders see as the start of a takeover of an otherwise largely apolitical agency. The appointment of Emily Miller, a right-wing activist who has ping-ponged between government and conservative journalism for the past two decades, has particularly dispirited FDA staff, senior agency officials said, speaking on the condition of anonymity. Miller joined FDA on August 17th as Assistant Commissioner for Media Affairs. The position is typically filled by non-political civil servants, not overtly political activists, making her appointment all the stranger. Miller is now the agency's top spokeswoman and liaison to the public, wrangling Hahn's media interviews and providing information to journalists covering the agency. Miller is an unconventional choice. She has no experience in science or medicine, and her work in politics and journalism has focused far more on foreign policy and gun rights issues than on healthcare. As a Washington Times columnist, Miller penned articles with titles including "Maryland's Bathroom Bill Benefits Fuse Transgenders, Puts All Girls at Risk from Pedophiles," and referencing advertisements promoting insurance coverage for birth control, "New Obamacare Ads Make Young Women Look Like Sluts." She later worked as a correspondent for the cable channel One America News Network, a right-wing news source openly allied with Trump and known for promoting conspiracy theories. "Trump is in a re-election battle," said Daniel Carpenter, a Harvard professor of government and FDA expert, "and unlike past presidents, he's willing to use the FDA as part of his arsenal." The FDA antagonism extended to Trump's senior aides, too. Peter Navarro, a top White House trade advisor, has reportedly told FDA officials, "You are all deep state and you need to get on Trump time." Mark Meadows, the former Republican congressman serving as Trump's chief of staff, also defended the president's, quote, deep state tweet in an ABC News interview, citing, quote, "a real frustration with some of the bureaucrats," and a desire to make sure FDA scientists, quote, "feel the heat." Trump's move to delegitimize FDA and other administration decisions that effectively strip it of his regulatory power have taken place against the backdrop of other controversial advocacy surrounding the agency's authority. In the first years of his presidency, Trump aggressively supported right-to-try legislation that became law in 2018. The administration has argued the law helps patients with terminal illnesses request unapproved drugs from pharmaceutical companies as a last resort, even if they haven't been thoroughly vetted for safety or effectiveness. "It plays into the same theme," said Hamburg, the former FDA commissioner. "It also signals that even after we get out from under this COVID crisis, the FDA will be very, very vulnerable if Trump remains in office. And these kinds of anti-FDA, anti-regulatory policies continue to be elaborated and implemented."
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you, your friends and loved ones, your city, state, your entire nation, suffer from an unprecedented crisis? Then your body politic may be infected with TLTL 2020 virus, also known as the TL20 squared virus. This too little too late 2020 virus has many vague and contradicting symptoms, but it is known to be exacerbated by election years. Do you suffer from exponential anxiety, worldwide depression, and recurring hallucinations of unimpeachable leadership? Don't worry, as the 2020 campaign season heats up, this will all go away. We don't call it a novelty virus for nothing. Hey people, don't look down. Things are looking up. Body bag futures are looking fantastic. This promises to be the best pandemic ever. Incredible things will happen as you save the world by doing nothing but watching TV. But remember, only get your Nothing Burgers from the drive-through window. Please note, Nothing Burgers will now be referred to as Patriot Burgers. Doing too little has never been easier. Hey, what's the worst? That could happen. This message is brought to you by Cassandra Reproductions, seer of unbelievable futures, and maker of Pickled Posterity, coming too little, too late to a shuttered store near you. You may now return to your regular programming.
Okay, well, and some good news about that conservative political hack who was appointed as a spokesperson for FDA. This from The Hill: top FDA spokeswoman ousted after 11 days. Top Food and Drug Administration spokeswoman Emily Miller has been removed from her position after 11 days on the job, according to multiple reports. Miller's removal comes amid the fallout over the agency's decision to use an emergency use authorization for convalescent plasma to treat COVID-19 patients. As agency spokeswoman, Miller was a key player in the FDA's announcement that it was authorizing the use of convalescent plasma. The decision almost immediately came under fire and raised questions about the FDA's ability to withstand political pressure from the White House. During a press conference announcing the decision, Commissioner Hahn greatly exaggerated the benefit of the therapy by saying a study found it resulted in a 35% improvement in survival. Miller defended Hahn's misstatement even after he apologized. Okay, well, this next story from the Center for Public Integrity really gets at the heart of the bad, inconsistent, fragmentary messaging that the federal government, the Trump administration, has been conducting. Analysis: Trump administration's coronavirus advice is secret, fragmented, and contradictory. Private calls and unpublished reports leave many Americans and local officials in the dark. From behind a podium in a black mask, Tulsa Mayor G.T. Bynum faced the press. It was late July, and 1% of his city had tested positive for COVID-19 since the beginning of the pandemic. A reporter had a question. What did Bynum have to say about the newly leaked White House Coronavirus Task Force document that recommended Tulsa close bars and limit gatherings to 10 people? The, quote, alleged White House document was never officially presented to us by either the federal government or the state government, the mayor said, but he was familiar with the document's recommendations, having read them online. All of that remains very much on the table. Okay, I'd like to take a personal note here. I've seen this released reports where they do this like on at least a weekly basis. And this was like a report that was like 80 pages long, very detailed, breaking down state by state and even by metropolitan area, all these indicators. And this is a secret document. They will not publish these on a regular basis. There's no good reason to withhold this information. And I'm really glad that they're reporting on this now, because this really is really public health malpractice not to do it. Okay, well, fast forward a month. At a press conference that looked exactly like the last, and Bynum still hadn't received any of the weekly reports from the White House, it was news to me that there had been 8 different reports. I only knew about the one that was leaked to the media, he said. That's all data that, of course, we would like to know. Indeed, the White House reports, chock full of local data and recommendations, would be useful for many city leaders, many of whom still don't know what percentage of coronavirus tests in their metro areas are positive. But Bynum and others didn't have that information. The White House was sending each state's report directly to its governor and a select group of other officials instead of distributing the documents widely or even posting them publicly. The nation's coronavirus response must be locally executed, state managed, federally supported, White House officials have said repeatedly. In fact, much of their public health advice has been secret, segmented, and inconsistent. Federal guidance isn't always reaching the local officials it's meant to support, and scattershot messages mean the average citizen weighing visits to grandparents or countless other daily risks have limited and sometimes conflicting information from the officials they're expected to trust. In late June, the White House Coronavirus Task Force began sending reports to governors showing how their states were faring in the pandemic. Dr. Deborah Birx, a leader of the task force, held the documents aloft at a press conference July 8th, but they weren't distributed to reporters. Birx said several states were in the coronavirus red zone with high numbers of cases and should take special precautions. But Vice President Mike Pence delivered the primary message of the press conference: reopen schools. Later that month, the Center for Public Integrity obtained a copy of the compiled report for all 50 states and published it, revealing that 18 states were in the red zone. The next morning, Presidential Advisor Kellyanne Conway suggested Public Integrity, a 30-year-old nonprofit, nonpartisan newsroom, had nefarious motives for disclosing public information. Quote, I don't know about that particular document, and respectfully, the Center for Public Integrity is an outside organization that I'm sure doesn't support the president's election, she told reporters. A spokesman for Pence, Devin O'Malley, later acknowledged the document's authenticity, but the White House still didn't release the reports and stayed mum on why it was keeping them secret. Weeks later, White House spokesman Judge Deere sent an email to Public Integrity that didn't quite answer the question. The White House Coronavirus Task Force is providing tailored recommendations weekly to every governor and health commissioner for their state and counties, he wrote. Local leaders are best positioned to make on-the-ground decisions for their communities. The United States will not be shut down again. Meanwhile, Birx hit the road, zigzagging across the country to meet with governors in person and privately urge some of them to ratchet up virus precautions. Unclosed to the press conference calls with state and local officials, Birx warned individual cities that they should take, quote, aggressive action to curb the coronavirus, according to recordings obtained by Public Integrity. But officials from those cities weren't always on the calls. Baltimore and Cleveland leaders missed a call in which Birx pinpointed them, and some of them weren't getting the report she was referencing. In late August, the most recent White House report the Arkansas Department of Health had was 3 weeks old. Public health experts say the report should be public. This is a pandemic, Harvard epidemiologist Bill Handage told Public Integrity. You cannot hide it under the carpet. Dr. David Rubin, who has provided epidemiological modeling to the task force as director of policy lab at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia Research Institute, is also befuddled as to why the reports are secret. I think we'd be in a lot of different place today if we had national standards around certain things, he said. But he doesn't blame Birx or other scientists working with the White House. They're playing the hand that they were dealt. Who do you listen to? Splitting public health advice into pieces means that some of those fragments don't line up. On a private call with state and local leaders earlier this month, Birx said colleges should be testing students as they return to campus and even be prepared to do 5,000 or 10,000 tests in one day. But the CDC hasn't endorsed such testing because its effectiveness hasn't been, quote, systematically studied. Nowhere has the fractured advice been more evident than on the topic of how to reopen K-12 schools. The CDC in May issued guidelines, but later replaced them with a more lenient version after the president objected. After insisting schools open their doors, Trump acknowledged that some hotspots may need to delay opening. CDC Director Robert Redfield said that schools should go virtual if their areas have more than 5% test positivity, a threshold that only 17 states and the District of Columbia met as of August 26, according to the New York Times tracker. Birx has stayed noticeably quiet on the topic. The secret reports from her task force recently endorsed West Virginia school reopening guidelines, which said schools must switch to virtual learning if daily new cases in a county exceeded 25 per 100,000 residents. All this leaves local officials with a dizzying set of choices and advice, stuck making decisions others don't want blame for. In addition, perhaps due in part to the mixed messaging, whatever advice the White House does have isn't always followed. In Arkansas, where the task force has recommended that bars close, they remain open. In Georgia, where the task force recommended a state mask mandate, Governor Brian Kemp sued to block Atlanta from requiring face coverings, though he later relented. In Tennessee in July, Governor Bill Lee ignored Birx suggesting that he close bars, limit indoor dining, and mandate masks. All this has meant that in the first major pandemic in a century, despite the feeble and disjointed efforts of the White House to corral them, the United States were not united, not even in the messages sent to citizens. That is, some experts worried about what's to come in the fall, when the reluctance of some to be vaccinated could mean the nation fails to reach the threshold for herd immunity that could protect everyone. Rivera of the COVID Tracking Project is absolutely terrified about the possibility. United messaging is key when trying to help people understand the scientific rigor behind a vaccine. All it takes is one rumor to completely shift public health behavior. In Tulsa, Bynum can now see all the White House reports. That's because Public Integrity published a recent Oklahoma report, and local journalists pressed the governor on why he hadn't handed it out. Last week, he agreed to post all the state's White House reports. In other parts of the country, people still don't know what White House experts are saying about their states or counties. The federal map of red, yellow, and green zones, an easy-to-understand stoplight that could help people quickly decide whether to cross state lines, for example, remains off-limits to the public. President Trump resumed daily coronavirus briefings this month, but Birx remains relegated to private calls and local press briefings on her treks across states. The CDC continues its silence. Fauci is recovering from a vocal cord surgery, and can't speak. For more than a century, Congress has given the federal government a prominent role in helping stop the spread of disease from state to state. Americans can debate whether governors or the president should make the big decisions in this particular pandemic, but neither statute nor scientific wisdom puts limits on the federal government's ability to dole out health advice, and there is no national security reason to make such advice secret. Okay, in the It's About Time category, this from The Hill. Trump administration to require nursing homes test staff for COVID-19. The Trump administration will require nursing home tests Staff for COVID-19 and facilities that don't comply could face financial penalties. The new requirement issued by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Service and effective immediately come about 6 months after the virus began circulating in American nursing homes, killing tens of thousands of mostly elderly residents and sickening hundreds of thousands more. During the early stages of the pandemic, there were not enough kits available to perform tests on staff members. Now, 6 months into the pandemic, enough testing is available to require testing of staff who are thought to be the main spreaders of virus in nursing homes. By the way, though, the nursing home residents can decline to be tested if they deem so. Okay, next up from Science Daily. Failure to flatten the curve may kill more people than we thought. New research by the University of Minnesota and the University of Washington find that every 6 additional ICU beds or 7 additional non-ICU beds filled by COVID-19 patients leads to 1 additional COVID-19 death over the following week. A spike in hospitalization naturally leads to more deaths, but these deaths may not only come from those who are hospitalized, but also from those who should have been hospitalized but were not, said co-author Anirban Basu, a University of Washington professor of health economics. Results of the study published in the Journal of General Internal Medicine show the impact of ICU bed use remains fairly constant as ICU bed availability changes. These effects are also in line with recent literature estimates for the mortality among COVID-19 patients receiving critical care that show mortality rates increase as ICUs fill up. Even when, say, 80% of non-ICU beds are still available, a further increase in COVID-19 admissions leads to significantly more numbers of deaths than what you would expect from only the hospitalized patients. This may be because the healthcare delivery within a hospital is not only driven by hospital beds, but also personnel and COVID-specific supplies, which may be stretched thin and affecting COVID-19 admission policies of the hospitals. Consequently, Basu said efforts to, quote, flatten the curve, that is, reduce or stop the increase of people infected with the novel coronavirus through public health measures such as mask wearing and physical distancing, are more important than simply keeping hospitals from becoming overwhelmed. Failure to flatten the curve, even before hospitals reach capacity, is killing more people than just those who end up in hospital beds. These results have very important implications as large numbers of students head back to schools and colleges across the nation, and resistance to public health measures continues to stymie efforts to reduce the number of infected. Well, this just shows you how the whole notion that I've spoken to earlier, particularly some governors have really basically said, well, if we have enough ICU beds, you know, what's the problem? You know, that's the level of infection that we're worrying about, the line we don't want to cross. But the reality is, obviously, life is much more nuanced. And basically, the more people you have in the hospital, the more additional people are going to die because of strains on the hospital system. And a related story from Science Daily, wide variation across hospitals in nurse staffing is a threat to public's health. According to a new study published in the British Medical Journal, Quality and Safety, many hospitals in New York and Illinois were understaffed right before the first surge of critical ill COVID-19 patients. The study, Chronicle Hospital Nurse Understaffing Meets COVID-19, documented staffing ratios that varied from 3 to 10 patients for each nurse on general adult medical and surgical units. ICU nurse staffing was better, but also varied significantly across hospitals. New York City, an international gateway to the U.S. with 3 major international airports and the early epicenter of the COVID-19 surge in the U.S., had the poorest average hospital nurse staffing on the eve of the COVID-19 medical emergency. Researchers at the University of Pennsylvania found that the workload had adverse consequences on nurses and on patient care. 1/3 of patients in New York State and Illinois hospitals did not give their hospitals excellent ratings and would not definitely recommend their hospital to family and friends needing care. Half of nurses right before the COVID-19 emergency scored in the high burnout range due to high workloads, and 1 in 5 nurses said they plan to leave their job within a year, said lead author Karen Lassiter, an assistant professor and researcher at the Center for Health Outcomes and Policy Research at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. It is an immense credit to nurses that in such an exhausted and depleted state before the pandemic, they were able to reach deep within themselves to stay at the hospital bedside very long hours and save lives during the emergency. It is very important for the public to take note that in this large study of nurses practicing in New York and Illinois hospitals, half of nurses gave their hospitals unfavorable grades on patient safety, and 2/3 would not definitely recommend their hospital to family and friends. She noted that nurses have been rated in the Gallup poll as the profession's profession most trusted by the American public for the past 18 years. Okay, well, next up from the Hill, another interesting article about how the infrastructure of our society affects our health. The U.S. Postal Service is a vital part of our healthcare system. Since its inception, the U.S. Postal Service has been an integral part of our country's ability to share information and goods. Today, operational changes, both proposed and already in effect at the U.S. Postal Service, have led to mail service delays with far-reaching consequences. While the focus on our democratic election process is crucial and a good fight, the effects ripple across our country and are already being felt by many. The Postal Service has become a vital part of the U.S. healthcare system. Disruptions to the U.S. mail will create barriers to healthcare access for those who depend on the Postal Service for their medications. While typically around 5% of prescriptions are filled in the U.S. are through mail order channels, a recent consumer survey conducted by the Alliance for Community Health Plans found that nearly a quarter of respondents shared that they depend on the mail for their medicines during the pandemic. For the millions of Americans who rely on mail order medications, the delays have made medication delivery less reliable and unpredictable, jeopardizing health outcomes. Mail service medication delivery is a valuable tool used to increase patient safety, offer patient convenience, and maintain the affordability of prescription drugs as a whole. There's also evidence that Postal Service medication delivery improves adherence and lowers dispensing error rates, both critical to improving patient health outcomes. Delays also have a disproportionate impact on communities that often already lack sufficient access to medical care. While patients in city centers may be able to turn to an emergency prescription at a local community pharmacy, which can still present problems, rural communities often lack the same healthcare infrastructure, and the nearest pharmacy may be hours away. Our federal government itself relies heavily on the Postal Service to deliver medication to patients. The Department of Veterans Affairs provides 80% of outpatient prescriptions via mail order pharmacy. A slowed system kneecaps the department's ability to get medications to our nation's veterans. Mail service pharmacies can help manage the cost of prescription drug benefits as a whole. As a result of high volume purchasing, mail service pharmacies are frequently able to secure lower prices for prescription drugs, and savings are passed on to the consumer. Please save our post office. Okay, I want to switch gears here and do several stories on racial and ethnic inequalities in healthcare. This from ProPublica. Black diabetics lose limbs at triple the rate of others. Here's how healthcare leaders are starting to act. Prompted by a ProPublica story that detailed how black Americans with diabetes lose limbs at a rate triple that of others, the American Diabetes Association has included an initiative to prevent unnecessary amputations as part of an unprecedented campaign to reduce racial disparities in diabetes care. The ProPublica article raised the consciousness of what the problem is, said Tracy Brown, the CEO of the American Diabetes Association. Every 4 minutes, someone is losing a limb from diabetic complications. That's ridiculous. We've got to find a way to drive change. The story highlighted obstacles to equitable care for diabetic persons at risk of amputation. From the government's decision not to endorse screening at-risk patients for vascular disease in the legs, to the inadequate incentives for certain specialists to move to underserved areas, to the health system's failure to consider limb-saving options before permitting surgeons to apply a blade. In the weeks that followed publication, several congressional and state legislative offices reached out to the association to ask for guidance on drafting policy to reduce disparities in diabetic amputations. In response, the organization decided to build an agenda around the issue. The American Diabetes Association Health Equity Now campaign, which addresses the cost of diabetes care, nutrition, discrimination, and more, was motivated by the racial health disparities that have been exposed by COVID-19, which has hit black Americans with diabetes particularly hard. As part of the project, the association has built a health equity bill of rights, asserting that all diabetes patients are entitled to affordable drugs, healthy food, the latest medical advances, and other protections. The right to avoid preventable amputations is the only complication of uncontrolled diabetes that is included in the list. The organization is sharing the document with policyholders, practitioners, and patients as it begins to look toward policy change. It is also encouraging members of the public to ask their governors to support the project. Dr. Ronald Dahlman, the president of Society for Vascular Surgery, said, "I commend the American Diabetes Association for doubling down on this particular complication of poorly managed diabetes. It's a long overdue prioritization." He added that it's a moment in time when we can leverage this concern about healthcare disparities to call out a very specific problem, the prevalence of amputation in certain subsets of the population. Dr. Gary Puckerane, the head of the National Minority Quality Forum, a nonprofit focused on reducing healthcare disparities, said that the American Diabetes Association's efforts are just a step. The American healthcare system was organized during an era when inequality was acceptable and mainstream in American society. It's not that African Americans are sicker, it's that the healthcare delivered is unequal. Okay, next up from US Today, black babies are more likely to survive when cared for by black doctors, study finds. Black newborns are more likely to survive during childbirth when cared for by black doctors, according to a new study. In the United States, black babies die at 3 times the rate of white newborns during their initial hospital stays, according to a peer-reviewed study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. But when black doctors cared for black babies, their mortality rate was cut in half. While this data doesn't tell us exactly why this happens, a mix of structural issues could have contributed, and each are really disturbing, said Brad Greenwood, study co-author and associate professor of information systems at George Mason University. The race of the doctor caring for white babies did not make much difference to the likelihood of survival, and there was no statistically significant improvement in maternal mortality, which is also higher for black women, when mothers were the same race as their doctor. The stark differences in infant mortality are not the result of a biological difference, but rather likely the legacy of structural racism, said study co-author Rachel Hardiman, a reproductive health equity researcher and associate professor at the University of Minnesota. She cited one theory that suggests black women are less healthy and at greater risk for negative health outcomes during pregnancy because of the cumulative effects of racism and socioeconomic disadvantage over the course of their lives. She said those effects, including limited access to health care and education, are the same factors behind the disproportionate effect of COVID-19 on people of color. We're talking about a social contract that has gotten under the skin, she said. Hardiman said infant mortality rates are often used by researchers as a marker of overall community health and well-being. The U.S. has a higher infant mortality rate than almost all other Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development countries, ranking higher only than Mexico, Turkey, and Chile. Although infant mortality rates overall have been declining for decades in the U.S., severe racial disparities remain. Research published by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in 2019 found that black babies died at double the rate of white, Asian, or Hispanic infants before their first birthday, regardless of the mother's income or education level. Both researchers cautioned that the data does not mean only black doctors should treat black patients, but rather illustrates the need to better educate all doctors on how to treat people of color. Hardiman said increasing diversity in the medical workforce could be one way to create change, noting that about 13% of the U.S. population is black, but just 5% of doctors are African American, according to the Association of American Medical Colleges. It would go a long way to helping with this, but also we don't know what the answer is necessarily, that we just need more black doctors. We have to be thinking about the healthcare institutions themselves and how physicians are being trained, to think about the role of race and racism in the clinical encounter, but also in people's lives outside of the healthcare settings. Okay, well, next up is an article from the Center for Health Journalism, and this is a really good article to get at some of the basis for these racial ethnic differences and inequalities that we see. Question your assumptions about racial differences in health. We've long given up the idea that justice is blind. We need to give up the idea that healthcare is blind, too. The notion that we are one human race, but that we still have different racial identities imposed upon us by a range of societal forces can be a very hard concept to internalize. There's extensive research showing that race can influence the amount and quality of care people receive. That means racism itself can cause poor health outcomes, but it can also limit access to care and lead to inferior care of patients of different races. A study from 2002, for example, found that self-reported racial discrimination at the individual level predicted poor health status, especially with mental health. Blacks were found to be less likely to see a physician than people identified as white or other racial categories. If blacks do gain access to care, the care itself is too often of lower quality. A study from 2007 found that blacks wait about an hour longer in the emergency room to receive care than non-blacks. If you experience a medical crisis that requires you to go to the emergency room, an hour is a very long time. One of the easiest examples to understand is the simple spirometer. Lundy Braun, a professor of medical sciences and Africana studies at Brown University, published a book in 2014 called Breathing Race into the Machine, The Surprising Career of the Spirometer from Plantation to Genetics. The next year, in an article in the Canadian Journal of Respiratory Therapy, she wrote about how the spirometer has gained widespread use across the world for the diagnosis and management of many respiratory diseases in both specialist and primary care settings. But the spirometer has also long been programmed with correction factors that adjust for lung capacity based on race. If you enter into a modern spirometer that a patient is black, the result will be adjusted by as much as 15%. That can mean the difference between a person being correctly diagnosed with the disease, misdiagnosed with something else, or not diagnosed at all and receiving treatment they need. Anne Fausto Sterling, one of Lundy's colleagues at Brown, wrote for the Boston Review in 2016. Technicians present spirometry results corrected for race so that for an African American to receive a diagnosis of impaired lung function, for example, a worker seeking disability compensation for lung damage from asbestos, he or she has to be dramatically sicker relative to a white American before receiving an equivalent disease diagnosis. Braun shows how these adjustments are based on little more than assumptions by white people that black people must have less lung capacity among many supposed deficiencies defined by race. Instead, as Braun notes, differences in lung capacity found when comparing people who appear or self-identify as white and people who appear or self-identify as black are much more likely to result from lived experience, environmental conditions, and other factors, but not race, which is a human-made construct. As Braun writes, across the globe, there's a continuum of human phenotypic and genetic variation that cannot be apportioned into discrete categories. By featuring race with only marginal attention to the intersection of race and social class, we risk ignoring the complex and dynamic relationship of lung function and the environment. We mistakenly choose race as the driver of differences in health outcomes instead of racism and discrimination of all kinds. That should make us think about the less obvious ways that fabricated racial divisions pervade healthcare. One of the ways journalists can rise to the occasion presented by the global protests against racism in all aspects of our lives is to look for the ways that racism has seeped into the fabric of our hospitals, clinics, and healthcare programs. They won't all be as obvious as the spirometer. Okay, well, I'd like to finish the show with a story of good news on the global scene. This from The Hill. Africa eliminates polio in historic health win. African leaders said the continent is free of wild poliovirus, a historic public health achievement that will spare tens of thousands of children from the devastating disease every year. The Africa Regional Certification Commission for Polio Eradication officially declared the continent free of polio 4 years after Nigeria reported the last known case. This is a momentous milestone for Africa. Now future generations of African children can live free of wild polio, said Matshidiso Moete, the World Health Organization's regional director. Poliovirus paralyzed an estimated 75,000 African children annually in the 1990s, when African nations began to push to eradicate the virus. Then South African President Nelson Mandela kicked off the continent-wide effort to end infections in 1996. Well, quarter of a century, here we are. Mission accomplished. Thank you, folks. Okay, well, that does it for the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. If you'd like to queue up future shows or look at past shows or re-listen to this show, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT, or you can look for Just for the Health of It, WAKT 106.1 FM on Facebook to find the Facebook page and get notifications from there. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.